Hey everybody, welcome to the first edition of This Week in MLS. I'm Jimmy Vance, I'm with 92 on the Game, executive producer of Atlanta United Radio, and I'm with Jason Longshore, Atlanta United color analyst for the radio for 92 on the Game. Jason, how you doing?
Doing well. What's going on?
Man, been talking to you about this project for a long time and finally getting to record it, and I feel like it's a good time to record it. Because, you know, we're about to get in the thick of it for, you know, MLS playoffs coming up, and kind of wanted to do a show about kind of just looking, you know, this past week in MLS and just chatting about kind of like what's coming up, you know, big games and maybe recap some other games. So let's get into this past weekend. First, you know, let's start with Atlanta United versus Philadelphia Union. 2-0 road victors for Atlanta United. And I wanted to talk about a few things about this match, about basically the two goals for Atlanta United, Jason. I know I've heard you on 92 on the Game today and talk about LGP's pass of the year. Tell us more about like what made this pass so good to set up the first goal.
Yeah, just to hit a ball with the outside of the right foot on a line like that, perfectly weighted to where Miguel Almiron just takes a touch and he's in on goal. I mean, there aren't many players in this league who can hit that ball, period, and especially not many center backs who are hitting that ball. I just love that Atlanta United plays with the freedom to allow a player to step up in a position that a lot of teams don't really have their center backs in, and Leandro is completely comfortable in getting involved in the attack and hitting that kind of ball. It's just a lucky thing for Atlanta United to have.
And also you said on Dukes and Bell earlier today on 92 on the Game that Atlanta United's playing a little long ball, but it's a little different long ball than maybe traditional, like, you know, in England, like what people think of the long ball. Maybe talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it's just focused, and I need to go back and do a little digging. It was actually a question after the Orlando match, and I didn't notice it as much in that one, but you go back and you start crunching the numbers, and Atlanta United had far more long balls in the Orlando match than their usual average, and it came back down to normal in the Dallas match, but against Philadelphia, it was back up there, and you know, we've talked about Brad Kazan and Leandro Gonzalez Pires being comfortable hitting that ball. We've seen Michael Parkhurst do it a little more here lately. And we've also seen Franco Escobar start to add that into his repertoire. So it's interesting. And we'll get into the long ball a little bit too with NYC and their win over the Red Bulls from the weekend. When teams put pressure on you, it can be a valuable weapon. And Philadelphia didn't really get a chance to do that as much against Atlanta United. I think the direct play was part of it. It's not the way Atlanta United does it, and the way I think stronger teams around this league do it. It's not about just hitting a hopeful long ball or a clearance and hoping someone gets on the end of it or wins a knockdown or whatever. It's definitely targeted. And I think the way Atlanta uses it specifically are those big switches. Those big either, you know, switches across the back line from left to right, right to left, or the long diagonal that we see Gonzalez Pires hit a lot to Tito Villalba or Miguel Almiron on the run. So it's a useful weapon. Atlanta has historically been among the top five teams in the league at playing the long ball. And I think that's only going to continue, especially with strong play here lately as they've upped that number a bit.
And before we get to Atlanta United's road record, just quickly, was that the best teamwork goal in Atlanta United history, in its brief history, the second goal?
It's up there. I don't know if it is the all-time best. I'll have to actually do a top five goals in Atlanta United history piece here at 92 on the Game coming up soon. I'll have to think about this one a little bit because everybody has different ones. I mean, for me, I think it'll be hard to top the Tito goal against Orlando at Bobby Dodd. That's kind of the winner for me, just from an emotional perspective.
Right.
The Tito goal in Orlando the week before was also a high one on the list. But there's been a few of these types of goals where it's just the interplay that you see from Atlanta United. This is a team that I'd love to figure out how many goals they score that are tap-ins like that, mm-hmm. or 1v1 with a goalkeeper at least. It feels like it's more than most, and I think that's why, you know, Atlanta is a team, or I mean, I guess it goes hand in hand, is a team that doesn't have a high number of shots per match, but has, you know, the most goals in the league. And I think they just are comfortable working the ball for a better chance. In some ways, it reminds me of the Hawks when they were really good under Mike Budenholzer. And that was always the conversation, is they would always make one more pass to make an even better look. And I think Atlanta United does that too. Doesn't always come off, and there's times where everybody is frustrated that, why didn't you just shoot? Why didn't you just shoot? I think Atlanta United has that confidence that they can work the ball into a better position to score, and they're pretty good at it.
And now the close off the Atlanta United Philly match is basically just talking about Atlanta United's road form this year. Quite incredible. Already 20 points in 10 matches. And there's 6 wins, 2 draws, and 2 losses. They're at 20 points right now on the road. The record is Seattle in 2011, 32 points on the road. They had 9 wins and 5 draws. Do you think Atlanta United breaks that record?
Yeah, I think so. When you look at the schedule coming up, and we'll get deeper into strength of schedule in a bit, but Atlanta United has a number of winnable games in their final 7 on the road. And I would be surprised if they don't at least get close to that. I think it would take a pretty big change in road form for that to happen. You look at last year, Toronto, which, you know, set the record for points in a season overall, only won 7 matches on the road. I don't think anyone won more than 7 last year on the road. It's not easy in this league to go out on the road and win games. And Atlanta United, I think in some ways, gets to play a little more freely on the road, because so many teams come into Mercedes-Benz Stadium and play ultra defensively, that Atlanta United, you know, is playing against, you know, a line of 4 and a line of 3 midfielders, or a line of 4 midfielders, or sometimes in Montreal's case, a line of 5 midfielders. And it's a different style of game. On the road, Philadelphia, you know, tried to play in front of their home fans and had some chances in the first half. But in an open match, I feel like it always favors Atlanta United. So on the road, they get to play more open matches.
And now let's go to our second match that was pretty big this past weekend, was Toronto and Sporting KC. Because Toronto, you know, started very slowly, and they're kind of running out of time. We'll get more into that. But, you know, this matchup, you know, it was back and forth. You know, Toronto took the lead, then Sporting KC hit 2 goals, and then Toronto got the equalizer. Talk a little bit more about this match. It was a very good, entertaining match.
Yeah, really interesting one. Jonathan Osorio scores in the 25th minute to give Toronto the lead. And as they've had a problem doing here lately, they conceded and gave up that lead. Ilya with a penalty in the 57th minute. Johnny Russell, one of the newcomers of the year, scores for Kansas City in the 61st. So Toronto goes from leading to losing in the span of 4 minutes. And maybe what can give Toronto a little bit of momentum, and I feel like we're constantly looking for something to give them some momentum, is that they did come back. And Jordan Hamilton scored the equalizer in the 69th minute. Long range shot, a really nice goal for Hamilton. Toronto just, I don't know what it is at this point for them. I mean, the injuries, and I think, you know, with guys like Drew Moore and Jozy Altidore still out, they are not the Toronto team that we expected at this point. And people will continue to point at CONCACAF Champions League. I don't think that has anything to do with it at this point. I don't think it caused any of the injuries. I think Toronto's just had a combination of awful luck, and, you know, when that happens and you won everything you wanted to win last year, maybe some of the, you know, motivation isn't there like it was last year, where you might play through this stuff before. When you've already won, it's a little bit easier to chalk it up to some bad luck and just play out the string. I think the question for Toronto is how long is Drew Moore and Jozy Altidore going to be out at this stage, and can they make that much of a difference when they get back? Because we never saw Toronto as a team that would blow leads, and it's happening far too often in 2018.
Yeah, I think you made a good point on maybe motivation a little bit. You know, it happens a lot in sports, you know, especially kind of like college football. Like when you have a team other than Alabama that wins the national championship, the next year, the motivation there isn't quite there. It's kind of you've reached that mountain, and now where do you go from there? And like, it takes, you know, really good franchises and teams to really build on that success. And also, what do you think about Giovinco's this contract situation with Toronto? He's kind of hasn't been the Giovinco of the years past.
No, I mean, it's got to be a little bit of a distraction. You know, when I say motivation, I don't think it's a situation where like Greg Vanney's lost the team or anything like that. I think it's just the fact when, you know, a good team that's won things has bad luck. And I mean, in injuries and the types of injuries Toronto's had, it's bad luck. And it's easy when you have that go against you to say, well, we'll be back next year. It's okay. It happens. We won everything last year. It's easy to let up a little bit. And that's what it kind of feels like watching this team. It's weird to see some of the work rate and the lapses in work rate that we're seeing from this team. I think the contract stuff for Giovinco has to be an issue. We saw Agger Akeche go back to Spain. Didn't work out for him joining this team. I think Toronto has some questions. You know, do they want to try to keep this group together for another run? Or, you know, when you have guys like Giovinco angling for more money, do you want to try to rebuild? And do you want to let a player of that ilk go? It's a tough spot for Toronto because you have to look at the short and the long term. You've got a number of older players that how many more years do they have? Do you want to keep propping the window open for this group? Or since you did win everything in 17, do you want to look to the next generation? And that's going to be a big question for the Toronto front office.
And just real quickly, I'm going to run down Toronto's next five matches. Basically, you know, we keep on saying, you know, they're running out of time, but like these next five fixtures we'll talk about later, but they play Orlando on the road this weekend. Then they play Chicago on the road, battling for a playoff spot. Then they've got Chicago at home. Then they've got Atlanta United away. And then they've got NYCFC at home. So, you know, five, you know, matches coming up are really going to tell a lot about this team, because after this, they're really running out of time.
I think the next three are what really tell the tale. And if they don't win two of those three, I think they're in big, big trouble. And the good thing for them is, you know, those three games are against teams that are right ahead of them in the table. So if you can get a little bit of momentum, win two of those three and leapfrog a little bit, you get some just positive motion going in the standings. And then that might be enough to spur this team on. We know they have the talent, but it's just not clicking for Toronto right now.
And now let's transition to Red Bulls versus NYCFC. A bunch of storylines going into this one, especially with this is fascinating that, you know, two of the top three teams in the Eastern Conference both have new managers. Jason, what were your thoughts on NYCFC's 1-0 win over the Red Bulls?
It was chaotic. I mean, most games at Yankee Stadium are interesting to see the two managers kind of, you know, put their imprint on this match. And Dolme Torrent for NYC was completely comfortable in changing up how the Pigeons play a bit. They were not the team that we've seen previously against the Red Bulls under Patrick Vieira that was not going to deviate from their plan of building out of the back. Under Torrent, they absolutely did. They got direct and just started skipping the midfield and avoiding those pressing situations that the Red Bulls thrive in. It made for a very disjointed, chaotic match, but it also served NYC well and helped them avoid trouble. I think they probably would have been happy with a point here, just as Dolme's kind of getting into the flow and protecting their goal, I think was number one. But then they get a goal late off of a mistake in the back from the Red Bulls. And Chris Armas, I thought, was a little bit slow to make adjustments. So NYC looks to be adjusting to their new manager a little bit quicker. He's had a little bit more time, too. You know, this was Armas's first match. I wonder how long it's going to take him to make that adjustment from being the number two, where he's giving advice to the head coach on moves, to having to make those moves himself.
Right. And that's just it. You know, it's one thing for being like the second in command, but then when you're in that situation where you've got to make the decision on which player and switching up tactics, you know, and midway in the game, like that's a little different. And we'll see how he adjusts. You know, he's been there for a couple years, but I'm really curious on how that moves forward on him, his in-game adjustments for the Red Bulls.
Yeah, I mean, it's as simple as for Jesse Marsh. I mean, he gets used to hearing Chris Armas, and he gets used to, you know, knowing kind of the way Armas is thinking and what changes he's seeing. Who does Armas have, you know, to give him that advice? You have to really trust your number two. And it's something here in Atlanta, you know, Jorge Thieler has worked with Tata Martino for a number of years, and they completely trust one another. Domi Torrent worked for Pep Guardiola for a number of years, and Pep described Torrent as, you know, more than his right-hand man. I think he like said he was an extension of him. Does Armas have somebody that can be that person for him straight away? Or is it another person who's kind of feeling their way into that role and they have a bigger voice than they're used to? Those are the little things like with the Red Bulls that you have to worry about, because the style of play is not going to change. Chris Armas has been there since 2015. It's going to be the same style. It's going to be probably the same lineup in general, but the changes in match and the reactions to things, that's the question for the Red Bulls. And how long does it take Armas to be truly comfortable in his new role?
Let's see. Now, I'm going to just list off a little bit of the standings currently for everybody. So I'm just going to do basically top six and maybe a couple teams below the playoffs. So we got Atlanta United number one. We got number two, NYCFC, who's got two matches in hand. We'll see what they can do. They're 6 points now currently behind Atlanta United. And we got Red Bulls behind them at 32. Then Columbus Crew, you know, kind of they're having, a little falter here midway through the season. We got New England at number five, and we got Montreal Impact now at number six. And then the Chicago Fire and Philly are closing behind them. And then for the Western Conference, we've got FC Dallas at number one at 35 points. Then we got LAFC number two, Sporting KC at three, Real Salt Lake at four, Portland Timbers with, you know, they've got two or three matches on hand and everybody in front of them. They're at number five, and Vancouver's at number six, and Houston Dynamo and LA Galaxy right behind their tails. What stands out to you on kind of the standings, Jason?
Montreal, five wins in their last six, four straight. And that run's coming after losing eight out of nine. You know, this is a Montreal team that Remy Gard really challenged in a number of ways and just said that they weren't good enough. Well, they're standing up a little bit to show their manager that they are. And, you know, you'd have to give Remy Gard some credit here. They also had a number of injuries in the back, and they're getting healthy. Sounds familiar, right? I think Montreal is a team to look at, because they do have some veteran talent in this group. And, you know, can they keep this run together and continue to make some noise in the Eastern Conference? Out West, I think Portland is playing the best soccer, even though they're sitting in fifth at the moment. They've only played 16 matches, so they do have some matches in hand. They were working on Providence Park at the beginning of the season. They went on a long road trip. They're 3-3-3 on the road. They've righted the ship there. They're 5-0-2 at home, and they haven't lost in 11 in league play. They haven't lost in 13 in all competitions. 8-0-3 in that run of league matches that they haven't lost. I think Portland is playing the best soccer of anyone in the Western Conference. LAFC is right there. LAFC only has one win against teams in the top eight, though, this season, and that was against Columbus, who is struggling. LAFC for me has to show that they can play on even terms with the top teams in the league. Dallas has beaten them. Portland beat them earlier this year at Providence Park. They have to step up a bit. And with Diomande up top scoring the way he is, 9 goals in 7 matches, they can do it. Defensively, can they hold up against the top teams? That's my question.
And now let's go to this MLS article that was posted today about basically the strength of remaining schedule for all the teams. And, you know, for Atlanta United fans, they've got like this, that they have the easiest schedule remaining. They went through, very tough, as NYCFC also has the third easiest schedule. Both of them, played a lot of the top teams. And now both of them, have the easier of the schedules. It's just seeing who can max those points out.
Yeah, it didn't really surprise me to see that. I've been tracking records against the top eight for a while now, and Atlanta and NYC have played the most matches against top eight teams in the league. So, you knew they were going to hit an easier run here at some point, and they have it in the second half. LAFC being one of the easier schedules surprised me a bit because they haven't played quite as many matches against top eight teams. I'm real curious to see how they do. I think the interesting part is some of the teams that are going to be battling for playoff spots that have such a tough schedule remaining. New England is a big one, and they've been a surprise this year. They're in fifth right now. They're 4 points clear of Montreal in sixth. They are 5 points clear of Chicago, who is the number one team outside of the playoff picture at the moment. New England has a game in hand on them. I think New England has the talent on the road that they have to start finding more points consistently. They're only 1-2-4 on the road. And that has to change, I think, for New England to guarantee themselves a playoff spot, because you look at the East and honestly, for me, it's all the way down to DC United because their schedule is just so unpredictable with 15 of their last 20 at home. If they get on a run at home, as we saw here last year at Mercedes-Benz for Atlanta United, DC United can make up the ground. They have 4 games in hand, 5 against some, 6 against others. If the Wayne Rooney signing is the right play and it can kind of give them a focal point going forward, because they've only scored 23 goals in 14 matches, they are a team that can compete for a playoff spot. And they're in last place. Toronto, with their talent, you don't want to count them out yet. Beyond that, Orlando is 5 points out of the final spot. Philadelphia is 3 points out of the final spot, and Chicago is 1 point out of the final spot. I think it's a battle between New England, Montreal, Chicago, Philly, Orlando, Toronto, and DC for the final 2 playoff spots in the East. And if Columbus isn't careful, they're going to fall into that conversation.
Yeah, and just looked this up, that 4 out of the 5 like teams in the East that are probably going to be battling for that 5th and 6th spot have the top, they're in the top 5, hardest schedules. We got New England, Chicago, Toronto, and Philly. So that is going to be a bloodbath in the Eastern Conference battling for those final spots. And just like you said, Columbus, they've got a tricky road ahead. These next 10 games, they have very tricky road matches against some of the top teams.
Yeah, it's not easy for Columbus at this stage when you look at what they have coming up. And, they started so well, but they've lost 3 of their last 4. And they go to Yankee Stadium next. Atlanta's the only team that's pulled points out of Yankee Stadium. Then Columbus hosts Orlando, where you're starting to get into desperation type of matches. Then they go to Red Bulls. That's 3 tough matches in different ways. They host Houston, who still isn't a very strong team on the road, but Houston's playing much better than they were in the middle of the season. Then they come to Atlanta. Then they go to Chicago. So you're getting to the stage where for Columbus, every match they have remaining has a lot of meaning to it. Probably you're waiting until late September when you host Colorado for a game that doesn't have a lot on the line if you're the Columbus Crew. And that wears on you after a while. We'll see what Greg Berhalter is really made of with this next month or two of their schedule.
And now let's go into a little part of the show. I'm gonna call it Stock Up and Stock Down. And Jason, okay. you can pick a team, a couple teams, or a player that's, you know, really, you know, impressing you this past week. So can you give me a team or a player for Stock Up?
Stock Up. On the team side, I will stick with Portland. I think they have just consistently raised their stock and impressed here in recent weeks. Player, Armenteros from Portland. I mean, you look at the forwards in this league right now. I don't know who's on better form between Diamande from LAFC, Armenteros from Portland, and Joseph Martinez. I mean, they're all just in such a rich vein of form. I don't know who's impacting their team more. Maybe Diamande, just because I think LAFC needed that type of presence during the World Cup when they were missing Carlos Vela. But Armenteros is keeping Fernando Adi out of the lineup. That's not an easy thing to do up in Portland. And we get to see it firsthand here in Atlanta, what Joseph Martinez does for this team, and scoring 18 goals this season is just about unheard of. So Armenteros is the one maybe that I didn't expect to be doing this on a regular basis. So he would be my stock up at this stage.
And for stock down?
Ooh, stock down. Looking at a team side of things.
You can't pick Orlando.
Yeah, too easy. They are where we know they are at this point. And I'm not going to pick a bad team at this stage because, you know, we kind of know their stock's not that great at the moment. Maybe Sporting Kansas City, and I don't think it's their fault. They've had a ton of injuries. I'm worried about what happens with them if Ike Opara is out for any extended period of time, and he left the match against Toronto injured. I don't know. They've kind of treaded water without with all the injuries they've been having. I mean, they've been playing a lot of the kids here lately, and that's a good thing in the long term. I think they do have good depth. But Opara and maybe Zusi are the ones that they just can't afford to miss. And if Opara is out for a while, they're going to have some problems. They haven't won in their last three. They have two losses in that, the draw with Toronto. They would be my team that has their stock down currently.
And now let's just go kind of around the league with MLS news. And first, I kind of wanted to talk about, we briefly mentioned it, DC United, Audie Fields' debut is coming up, I think, this weekend. And 15, like you're saying, 15 out of the next 20 at home. So DC United, you know, just like you're saying, can creep up that table if they start getting
There's
max
points
at home.
There's all kinds of things going on with DC United right now. So you're still having supporters group drama, and that's something that DC has to get sorted out. You have Wayne Rooney sitting at a presentation for the grand opening of Audi Field today. Looks like he was hating how hot it was in Washington. That's something he's going to have to deal with. He's out training with the team now. He'll make his debut this weekend at the inaugural match at Audi Field. You also had Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, who you don't know that name. I don't roll in these circles of guys who are worth $7.8 billion. So I didn't know the name either, but he addressed it at a recent investment summit in Los Angeles and said that there wasn't enough space on the two LA soccer teams. Soon I will be the majority owner of DC United. You get a guy worth $7.8 billion buying your team, you would expect that more money will be put into said team. That's a game changer for the Eastern Conference. You know, you get DC United into a stadium that is not falling down. You get an owner that's worth billions, and you add a player like Wayne Rooney. You know, you like it or not, in terms of if you like Rooney, you don't like Rooney, you think he's over the hill. You have a team that's relevant right now in DC for the first time in a long time. So this is going to be fascinating to watch from a distance, because you're getting a lot of blood pumped into this team right now. And in the short term, 15 home matches in your final 20, you've got a shot at making an incredible run and getting into the playoffs as kind of the ultimate underdog. But you also have the opportunity to transform this club back to where they used to be as one of the leading clubs in Major League Soccer. So I'm fascinated to see what happens in DC. And if the ownership change happens, which, I mean, I don't know why he would be telling people at an investment summit that he's going to be the majority owner if it's not going to happen. Billionaires usually don't brag like that. If all this goes down, you know, they're going to have a lot of momentum going into this last stretch of the season. And Wayne Rooney might not be the only name who comes into DC United this season.
And now let's switch to Miami. Let's talk about a little bit of their franchise stadium development. Jason, what can you tell us more about kind of their 25,000 seat stadium and what's all going on?
Once you added the Moss brothers to this ownership group, you were going to be able to do some bigger things in Miami. These are two guys who are just so well connected in the city, and they are looking at a different piece of land for their stadium. There's a lot of talk about the Overtown neighborhood and legal challenges that were going to slow things down there, and it wasn't a huge parcel of land. Now they're looking at the Mel Reese Country Club, which is owned by the city of Miami. It's a golf course that numbers actually just came out not too long ago as we record on Monday night, that this golf course has been losing money for years. And, you know, it's a city property. So you have, you know, a lot of people pretty surprised that money's been pumped into this facility and it's been losing money. Well, the Moss brothers want to make a $1 billion development on this land, and not a $1 billion stadium. It's going to be a 25,000 seat stadium, but it's a much larger development with a lot of green space, a lot of public soccer fields. It's a really interesting thing that I think it looks good on paper. They're not asking for public money to do it. They are asking the city commission on Thursday for this to go out to a public vote. They want the public to make this decision. So this is, you know, a group right now, it's very confident in getting this deal done and being able to develop it. They said in a TV interview yesterday that they, if everything happens the way they expect, they would be able to move into the stadium on this facility, on this property in 2021, which means they would play in 2020 at a temporary venue. And they didn't say where, but they kind of hinted at the two major stadiums in Dade County. And I'm assuming that would be either Marlins Park or Hard Rock Stadium. Hard Rock Stadium is actually a great venue for soccer, even if it's on a temporary basis for whatever the Miami team ends up being called. A couple other things from that interview. They won't be the Miami Freedom. That's the name of the proposed park that they want to build, is Miami Freedom Park. A couple names that have been trademarked revolve around something like Atletico Miami or Inter Miami or Internacional Miami or International Miami. Probably get shortened to Inter Miami. I think it'll be one of those. And they're expecting to be able to announce the name and colors and badge, and they even said uniforms, by the end of this month, and hire a general manager next month. So things are moving along in Miami pretty quickly.
And also, I heard you guys on Soccer Down Here talk about how they've had a couple of good quotes about, you know, kind of wanting to model after Atlanta United, you know, getting up and coming stars, you know, finding that kind of talent rather than, you know, getting, you know, older talent from Europe, that which they can still do. But, you know, trying to do the Atlanta United way by creating kind of the superstars.
Yeah, that surprised me a bit. I think in Miami, they need to do a little of both. I think Miami's just such a, I mean, Hollywood doesn't really apply, but it's such a big name kind of town. And we've seen it with the Miami Heat, that I think they would be smart to use one of their designated players on a name. Now, it doesn't have to be a 35 or 36 year old name. It could be a name very similar in age to David Beckham when he came to MLS at 31. You know, you get a guy at 29, 30, who is not at the end of their career, but also, you know, not an asset that you would probably sell later. If you get one of those guys and then you get a couple guys, you know, of the Almirón Barco type of ilk, then yeah, it would make a lot of sense for Miami. But I think they need a name in the way that like Atlanta didn't really need it. And it would just help get that club, I think, noticed even a little bit more. Unless they're just counting on Beckham's star power bringing that. I don't know if he can do that as part of the ownership group as opposed to being on the field, though.
And now let's kind of talk about some... It was like, yeah, not quite breaking news. There's been a lot of rumors going on about Jesse Marsh, you know, leaving Red Bulls. We were thinking it was going to be maybe a temporary, you know, manager position with Red Bull Leipzig in Germany in the Bundesliga. But it turns out now he's going to be an assistant coach. I think it's a 2-year contract. So for the people outside looking in that don't follow it, you would think that's a strange move, but maybe tell people why it might be a smart move for Jesse Marsh.
Yeah, it's an interesting move. So Red Bull Leipzig reached an agreement with Julian Nagelsmann, who is currently managing Hoffenheim in the Bundesliga. And Nagelsmann's contract runs out with Hoffenheim after the upcoming season. So he has signed on to come to Leipzig, but not until the 2019-2020 season. So they needed a manager. A lot of people thought maybe Marsh would get that opportunity for a season as an interim before Nagelsmann comes in. But Leipzig went in a different direction. It is Ralf Rangnick, who has been the sporting director for Red Bull soccer as a whole. Red Bull Salzburg in Austria, Red Bull Leipzig in Germany. He is now moving over to Leipzig permanently as a manager, or not permanently, as a manager for this season. Marsh is on an interesting deal because he is on a 2-year deal as an assistant. So, you know, it appears that he will be the transition from Rangnick this season to Nagelsmann next season. You could look at it in a bunch of different ways. Is it risky to leave New York mid-season to go be an assistant? Yeah, I think it is. You know, you have to look at Nagelsmann probably wanting to bring in his own people. So you have to hope that that works out if you're Jesse Marsh. But the Red Bull soccer organization thinks very highly of him. And he's went through his UEFA coaching badges. And, you know, there have been rumors for a long time about Marsh either moving to Salzburg or to Leipzig. So I feel like the fact that he's made this move, they would protect him and take care of him if it doesn't work out with Nagelsmann or, you know, another opportunity in the Red Bull soccer empire opens up. You would think that they would look out for Jesse Marsh. Was talking to someone, a good friend who knows the German game and German soccer scene really well. And he had an interesting perspective on it because from what he was telling me, in general, an American coach would never get this opportunity in the Bundesliga. It just wouldn't happen. There's still the stereotypes about American soccer and American coaches. However, Red Bull is doing things in the way that they want to do them. They don't really care about those old norms. So if anybody were to do it, it would be Red Bull to do that and bring an American over. And will this help Jesse Marsh's standing? You know, would it potentially give him the opportunity to manage in the Bundesliga? Probably not for anyone other than Red Bull. So, but it improves his standing with the Red Bull organization as a whole. I think there's always the possibility of going back to New York if that is a thing that makes sense for all parties. And I think there's the possibility of him going to Salzburg, or I believe Red Bull has a team in Brazil. I don't know what other parts of the world they have teams in, but it's a big opportunity in a lot of ways for Jesse Marsh. I think it's a good thing overall for the league, even if it's really awkward for New York Red Bulls fans in the short term. It's just part of the progression of Major League Soccer, and hopefully you will see more coaches get these opportunities to develop in MLS like Patrick Vieira and Jesse Marsh have, and be able to spread that knowledge to Europe, because I think it breaks down some of the perceptions and barriers for MLS as a whole.
And now to wrap it up, let's for the MLS news portion, let's talk about Seattle Sounders. Boy, they've been needing goals. Jarrett Smith, our friend, put out a statistic that Joseph Martinez has outscored Seattle Sounders 18-15. Now, they went in the transfer market and got a signing. Jason, what can you tell us more about the signing?
Yeah, they went and got somebody who can score some goals, that's for sure. Raul Ruiz Diaz from Peru. I played two matches for Peru at the recent World Cup, but where he's made his name is that with Morelia in Liga MX, 39 goals in 67 matches in the last 2 years there. He's 27 years old. It's a pretty substantial signing for Seattle. And the question is just how long does it take him to build up that connection with a guy like Nicolas Ladero and Christian Roldan? How long does it take him to start scoring goals for the Sounders? Because they desperately need it. Their back line has actually been pretty decent this year. They've only given up 22 goals in 17 matches. And their back line's carried them, honestly, for a few years now. But 15 goals in 17 matches is just not going to get the job done for you. Two wins at home, four losses at home is just, it's not going to do it. I think Seattle needs to turn the page on probably a few players. And even though the back line's still holding up, you wonder how long Chad Marshall and Roman Torres have left. Osvaldo Alonso is kind of starting to get phased out. Clint Dempsey, how much longer does he have? When Jordan Morris comes back, what's he going to be? He's just had, tough luck, I think, since his rookie season. And now after an injury, is he going to be the same player? So I think Seattle has a ton of questions right now. Ruiz Diaz answers some in the short term. And if he's going to stick around for a while, he can be a centerpiece to build around at 27. But I think there's even bigger questions in Seattle in the long term. And I don't know, what Garth Lagerwey as the GM and Brian Schmetzer as the manager are going to do to answer them.
And also he possibly can make his debut with the Bens this weekend. Is that right, Jason?
Yeah, he'll be eligible to play. The transfer window officially opens on Tuesday, the 10th. So his signing's already been announced. Paperwork's done. He will be officially eligible as of that day. So Sunday he could make his debut.
And now before we get into the MLS upcoming matches to watch, just a few announcements. Make sure we've got stoppage time on Wednesday at a new time at 1 p.m. because we're going to do a lead-in into we didn't want to compete against England-Croatia semifinal, Jason. So I don't think
it's coming home, Jimmy. It's coming home. It's
coming home. But we just want to let you know that stoppage time is at 1 p.m. on the 19 on the Game Facebook page. And let's see, Jason and Jarrett's, they've got this new kind of preview podcast going out, and I think it's going to go out on Friday. It'll be a Seattle preview for Atlanta United fans. So
yeah, we try to have that go out a couple days before a match. So be on the lookout, a couple days before each match. We only have one more Wednesday match, so we only have one more that's weird. But yeah, it'll go out on Thursdays or Fridays, depending on when the team plays.
And Jason, well, can you tell people a little bit more about your future schedule on 92 on the Game, when you're going to be on air doing radio hits?
Man, feels like every day, which is really cool. But this week I am booked for Rick and John midday, 1 o'clock. I'll actually be like parachuting into stoppage time. Jimmy and Mike will get it started, and I'll come running in when the glass breaks. 1 o'clock on 99 the Game. Then I'll be on with the Bunker Mentality, Andy and Jarvis, Friday night at 10:20 for the soccer kind of sort of themed AMA. It turns into all kinds of nonsense. People have listened and thought we were drunk. We weren't. I promise there was no drinking involved. We just get a little goofy, and Jarvis talks about crazy things involving nipples, and he doesn't like nipple stuff, but he likes wings, and you just got to listen. The promos are out there. Go check it out. And I'm sure I'll be on with some people this weekend, but I don't know what the schedules look like for that. I'm always on with Dukes and Bell as well on Mondays at 2:40. Great.
And now that's the final segment of the show. Let's talk about MLS upcoming matches to watch. Jason, this week we've got some good ones. Actually, starting Wednesday night, Chicago at home versus Philadelphia Union.
You're getting to this point now where these matches are not quite make or break, but two teams that are just outside of the playoff picture. A win would put Chicago into the playoff picture, bumping Montreal. Philadelphia win, you're getting into tie breaks, and they would probably jump ahead of Montreal. Actually, no, they would not on a win. So that's the first tie break. We'll keep you abreast of all the tiebreakers as we get deeper into it, because they will probably come into play for different spots in the standings. But the winner is in a really good spot between Chicago and Philly. The loser has to start wondering how many more points they can afford to lose. A draw, I don't think, really helps either one. So really interesting one on Wednesday. Chicago being at home, you would probably think they're in better shape, because Philadelphia is only 1-6-1 on the road this year.
And on Saturday, 7 p.m. kick, we've got NYCFC at home versus Columbus. So, Columbus, has been struggling lately, and they go into probably the hardest venue in MLS to get points out of, because Atlanta United has been the only team to get a result at Yankee Stadium this year.
Yeah, I think they're going to continue to struggle. I think NYC is going to get the win here, and Columbus is going to have to start looking over its shoulder a little bit.
And again, Saturday, Red Bulls at home versus Sporting KC. Kind of like you're saying, the Sporting KC, the stock's been a little down with injuries and stuff. Can you see Sporting KC going to Red Bulls getting a result?
Yeah, just because you wonder about Chris Armas. And Peter Vermes is one of the best managers in the league. Even with playing the kids, they've been able to continue to tread water at this point. On the points per game side of things, Sporting Kansas City is in fourth place in the Western Conference. They're in third right now in total points. But as we mentioned, Portland's only played 16 matches. So Kansas City, if they want to guarantee themselves a home match in the knockout round, or potentially get out of the knockout round, they're going to have to go get results in these types of matches. They've been pretty good on the road this season, 3-3-3. But the Red Bulls are 6-1-1 at home. They should win. And if Jesse Marsh was still there, I think they'd be the absolute clear favorites. But you just have to wonder, if the match is tight in the second half, is Chris Armas going to have the confidence at this stage to make a big change if it's needed? And he was really reluctant to make changes at Yankee Stadium on Sunday night. Is that going to be different at home now that he's had a match against Kansas City? I'm really intrigued to watch this one, and from a tactical perspective, watch how it plays out.
And also on Saturday night, we've got Orlando at home versus Toronto. And Jason, you've got a good name for this matchup. What is it?
The Desperation Derby. Orlando and Toronto. Orlando, how many losses do they have in a row now?
I think it's nine times.
That's ridiculous. Really?
It's I can't. And the crazy thing, Jason, you look in the numbers, they're only 5 points away from the playoff spot, and they have a game in hand.
Yep. It's true. And they also have a goal differential of negative 16, which is bonkers. Who knows what happens in this one? Orlando's back at home, and ordinarily you would think, okay, they're at home. Toronto's struggling. Toronto's only 1-6-2 this season on the road. Orlando's your favorites. If I was a betting man, I would not touch this one with a 10-foot pole. I'm not getting anywhere near trying to predict what happens in this one. It could be one of the most entertaining, insane matches of the season, or it could be a scoreless draw that everyone just wants to bang their head against the wall. Who knows?
I'll tell you, Jason, going back to Orlando, when they lost to LAFC 4-1, but I was impressed on Orlando, how they came out and really showed a really great effort and played really well And without that controversial VAR decision of the offside call, I mean, they're 2-2 late in that match and maybe have a chance to win it at LAFC, which is at top of the table. I'd maybe just spend just a quick moment on what do you think about James O'Connor?
Yeah, it was better, and you have a coaching change. You expect a little bit of a bump because you have players who are now trying to impress the new manager. And the effort was definitely better. But then when things did go against them, they folded and they gave up 2 goals in the span of 3 minutes. That's unacceptable. And they fell down 2-0 in the span of 4 minutes in the first half. That's unacceptable. So even though there are a few positives, you have to wonder what's wrong with this group, because I think it's more than the coaching side. It really feels like there's just something broken in this locker room, and I don't know if they have the people to change it or if the players who are there can change themselves. It's been the strangest team to look at this season, because when things start to go bad, it seems like the train completely flies off the tracks into the ravine instead of just being a little bit of a bumpy ride. And that's something Orlando has to fix.
You saw it firsthand, Jason, when you were there for the Atlanta United match, when they went down, were not getting calls, and they're in the midst of a six-match winning streak. The trains went off the tracks. It was a disaster. Crazy stuff going on in that locker room.
It's just weird. It's so weird. So they're such an unpredictable team at this stage. Against Toronto, who has equally been unpredictable, I don't know what happens in this one. I'll be watching it because it could be wildly entertaining, but I have no idea what happens there.
Atlanta United versus Seattle this weekend, you know, could be the largest TV audience in MLS history, Jason, with the World Cup tie-in leading into that match. And, you know, the Atlanta United and Mercedes-Benz is going to have a big kind of World Cup watch party there. That's going to be a really cool sight on Sunday.
Yeah, Sunday is going to be a fun day with the World Cup final at 11 o'clock, then Atlanta and Seattle on Fox at 2 o'clock. Could be, and I would expect that it will be, the most viewed MLS match in league history, coming off of a World Cup final and with Atlanta involved and with Seattle involved. I mean, two big fan bases, so should be a blast. On paper, it definitely favors the Five Stripes. Seattle has a defense that can frustrate Atlanta a little bit, but they're not really a pressing team, and I feel like Atlanta is better against teams that want to sit, like Seattle, especially teams that are a little bit older. I think they have more problems with teams that press well. So Seattle's not really that. I feel like Atlanta will break them down, and I feel like in front of 70,000, 71,000, maybe 72,000 plus, it will be raucous on a Sunday afternoon, and the crowd will really lift Atlanta to a nice win.
Finally, I think one of the MLS match of the weekend, LAFC versus Portland, after the Atlanta United Seattle match. Jason, your thoughts on some of the best top teams in the West?
I'm not going to know how to handle all this on Sunday, because Atlanta United and Seattle should end at 4 o'clock. Barring the World Cup final going into extra time and penalties and pushing the kickoff time back. So 4 o'clock, then the full-time report will be over roughly 5 o'clock. Then I record a podcast with Doug Robertson from the AJC. I'm usually talking to somebody at the radio station after the game. If I can wrap all that up by 6 and sit down and watch LAFC in Portland, it'll be a miracle. And it's a game I really want to see, because the match these two teams played earlier in Portland was one of the matches of the season, and LAFC now gets them at home. I hope the Bank of California Stadium is packed. Crowds have been good, but LA, late arriving and maybe buying tickets but not showing up at times. I want to see a wild crowd in LA for a team that is playing great soccer right now, very entertaining, and a team that's playing the hottest team in MLS. Portland's a team that, as we saw here in Atlanta, is comfortable sitting back and playing the 4-3-2-1 or the 5-3-2, like we saw, turn into a 5-4-1 at times. They will sit, they will defend, they will counter, and LAFC is a team that you can definitely counter against. Atlanta did it to perfection at Mercedes-Benz earlier this season. So I feel like, even though Portland's going to come in with a defensive approach, that this could be one of those 3-2-4-3 types of matches. And I'm really of the belief that Portland's going to get the win. I need to see LAFC really show up in a big way against a big team. Their biggest win of the season right now is against the Columbus Crew. That's not a win that you can put up on the wall and say this is an MLS Cup contender. You win this weekend against Portland and you snap their 11-match unbeaten streak, that's your signature win. I think LAFC really needs one of those right now.
Jay, that's the show, everybody. Thanks for joining us for the debut of This Week in MLS. And Jason, really appreciate you coming on chatting MLS with us.
Yeah, anytime. I love talking about the rest of the league. It's a fun 2018 season. I think there are lots of twists and turns left for Atlanta United and for everybody else in the league. It's is the most entertaining season.
Thanks,
in
everybody,
MLS I can
and
remember.
We'll be doing this probably Monday nights or maybe Tuesdays, but we're gonna try to stick with Monday nights and get this out to you late Monday. So thanks again for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.